The Protect Your Neck Podcast, After Party Edition. From busted knees to Korean zombies, UFC Houston had it all.
Hot air hangs like a dead man from a white oak tree. People sitting on porches thinking how things used to be. Dark night. It's a dark night. Dark.
Up, you savages. This is the Protect Your Neck Podcast, and I am your host, Dan Tom, analyst and writer for FlowCombat.com. This is the place where we focus on high-level mixed martial arts and even sometimes MMA history in our top five episodes, but not tonight. This is an after-party edition, so aptly named, even though it's actually, I'm not going to lie, it's the day after. Did not get this off at night like I wanted to, got to come clean, so we are doing it Super Bowl day, so this is a little more of a recap, so pardon the title, but, you know, we're gonna keep consistent with the title and keep consistent with recapping the action and bets and what was a crazy night for UFC Houston. Yeah, I mean, it was one of those cards on paper that didn't have a lot of name value, but if you're familiar with the sport and the names, you're like, okay, there's some good matchups here. So, there's a lot to talk about, a lot of key points, so we'll probably get started right away, and we're going to go from bottom to top, maybe take a break in the middle, see how the pace goes. But the good thing about doing it the day after is certain things came up, and which we can actually shed a little more light on, but that'll be toward the end of the prelim card. The beginning of the prelim card was a good old buddy of mine, Khalil Roundtree. Not a good old buddy, but you know, we shared a lot of mutual friends and growing up in the same music scene, attending the same shows and so forth. Brian Schoonover, who's been on the After Party editions before, you guys heard. He was good buddies with Khalil, and we knew when he was kind of quiet 300-pound, overweight dude, and now he's, this 205 monster just developing and doing well. You know, he had a rough start, self-admittedly wasn't taking it, seriously, maybe as he should have, mentally, physically, maybe more so the mentally and the attitude, but he comes through. Daniel Jolly, not the most, critically acclaimed opponent, only had one appearance against Misha Cirkunov, against the Holloway Oliveira card. But Jolly tried to do some things. He spent 10 to 12 weeks at ATT, took this very seriously, did not waste any time looking at the tape on Khalil by trying to take him to the ground. And Khalil did good with a nice overhook and posting hand there as he used the knee to take him out. Some people saying the chest, some people saying the head. Was the second knee, that people had a problem with, that Khalil threw, but I think a little more, not that I'm advocating you point the finger, but I think the ref's positioning and stoppage a little more to blame at that point, because Khalil kind of stopped and almost seemed like he glanced over to the ref, like, are we going to stop this? Okay, one more for good measure then, and there it went. Hopefully Jolly's okay regardless, though, but I don't think too heavily criticism should go to Khalil for that one. A little biased, obviously, with that. If anything, maybe a little bit to the ref. But we'll get more to the officials and stuff later. Next one was Nico Price versus Morono. I have Morono here. This was the first of many misses, this card. As many of you, probably didn't, have the best picking records for this card either. But this is one where I just felt Morono was going to kind of make it ugly, which he did. But I thought that was going to be, I thought it was going to benefit him. It was going to be on his terms. And he did good almost, you could maybe argue that he could have, maybe finished Nico Price if there's maybe 30 more seconds or so in round one. But Nico Price is tough, and he showed that. He calmed himself. You could tell he was a little bit frustrated, but came out and kept pushing forward. And you kind of see that. In looking at the very limited footage, mind you, that's out there on Price, but this guy is a gamer, at least so far, and only two fights into the UFC and not the most touted prospects, despite Thatch being so at one time. Can't take anything away from Price there. Definitely has some spark and some attitude, so we'll see what happens with him. But man, that was a brutal knockout as Moreno kind of got sloppy. I don't know if he was getting tired, but he relied too heavily on his trunk movement and got caught. And it was very reminiscent to, you know, I was talking about a lot about, what was it, UFC Fight Night 13, Kenny Florian Lozon. I kept referencing like on an earlier episode. And I think another fight on that card was a welterweight Rumble Johnson versus Tommy Spear. And if y'all have been around, that's kind of what that knockout matched. So that was pretty intense there. We'll move on to Torres Rawlings. Not much to say here. Played Torres. She was the first of three parlay pieces, which we hit all three, despite, you know, spoiler alert, going 6-6 for the night. And the first of those three was Torres. And I also played her on the side by decision, which went to chalk pretty fast. But low chalk, I think I got it for -105. And I saw it maybe close around, I don't know, was it -120? I don't know. I'm pretty bad at that, remembering that. But not much to say here. If you know Torres's game, she pretty much got it off. It is kind of a, whether you like Rawlings or not, it's, I'm a big waver of the flag that they need a 125. And I don't know if how much that's going to help a Rawlings per se. So maybe that's not the best example, but she is definitely one of those prime candidates that would probably do better there than trying to kill herself to make that cut. Yeah, good on Torres. Hopefully she can put a little more together, maybe round out the checkmate part of the game. She's doing really good at the in-between, but that kind of checkmate part, you know, we'll see how she develops there. I mean, that's kind of her game. Kind of expected to go over decision plays with it when it comes to Torres. The next one was Ramos versus Tanaka. I had Tanaka here because, again, I thought it, you know, similar to Moreno, I thought it was going to be able to make it an ugly fight with his experience and make that ugliness kind of go to his terms. Did not do so, you know, so much. Got a rough start. Ramos looked great. Not only did he drop him and almost finish him, but he seemed pretty composed for a youngin, and he did a lot of growing. It wasn't just him saying that he did a lot of growing after losing and you're looking for a fight when Dana White first showed up. But, you know, you could see it. But you could also say that composure was conserving the gas tank because he arguably started to fade later. Where I kind of scored this for Tanaka, 29-28, I saw a lot of people saying draw, and I was like, you know, that's probably much more appropriate. And I knew in the back of my mind that Ramos could very well win, and I wouldn't be upset, nor was I upset when they called it. If anything, I have a problem with the 30-27 scorecard, and then, you know, scoring all the rounds for Ramos when I believe Tanaka outstruck him in that last round. And, you know, the timidity thing, I don't think that was just. I think that was the crowd playing into the ref, and then unfortunately the crowd and the ref maybe may have then played into the scorecards and influenced those judges. Because not only did I think, you know, Tanaka was doing enough, and it's hard, right? Because counterfighting is not heavily favored amongst judges, not heavily favored amongst fans, not heavily favored amongst refs, right? Because the refs get put in between the judges and the fans, and we see situations happen like this, even with the best of them. Which was it Herb? I want to say, I believe we had a veteran ref doing that as well. And yeah, I did not agree. Not only did I feel that again that Tanaka was doing enough, but when you incorporate the fact that Ramos wasn't even throwing. He was moving forward, but he wasn't even like doing those faint paw jabs where like I'm out 5 feet away. You know, I'm just going to pointlessly throw. And even if he did a little bit of that, then he could have kind of maybe justified an intervention for Herb Dean to, you know, encourage more action. But he didn't even do that. And a lot of times you'll see guys kind of, you know, playing the politics of it, you know, where if they can't, you know, sell off that they're doing offense with physical strikes, they will kind of do it politically, like a basketball player drawing an offensive foul, or, you know, they'll put the hands up like Nick Diaz and go, what? Come on, exchange with me. And I think even if Ramos did that, he could have maybe made it more justifiable, but none of that was going on. He really wasn't doing anything. And even with his, you know, circling outside movement at Tanaka, he was still throwing and landing much more. So just my opinion. Not a crime, not a robbery either way. Just kind of food for thought there. Excited to see where Ramos goes. Obviously, he's got the higher ceiling, even though I picked against him here. So, and yeah, we'll see what Tanaka does from here as well. Next was a big one. First prop, second parlay piece, Chaz Skelly. Skelly by submission prop again hits. He's really enabling me here. Man, these Skelly sub props, you know, against Kevin Souza, it hit, which was really nice. And it hit here tonight again. And Skelly also comes through against Grootschmacher. Again, who I just didn't see anything in his game that was going to liken me to lean toward him here, you know. And he even switched camps. He went away from the MMA lab, and whoever his new camp was not that great at all. They gave him poor corner advice, in my opinion. It's kind of cringeworthy, I believe, is what my notes say here. Yeah, Skelly just did a really good job of kind of using his awkward grappling style. You know, he leg rides really well. He understands levers, you know, kind of busting guys out, sprawling them out. And those kind of awkward funk style wrestlers who I kind of like watching wrestle translate well to grappling. And I love awkward grapplers, being kind of an awkward grappler myself, because awkward grapplers are often underrated grapplers. And when we're looking at betting and stuff, which is probably the only reason, one of the only reasons why you're listening to this, those are the kind of guys where you can get good lines on. Those are the guys where the black belt in jiu-jitsu that has often been sadly underwhelming, because it doesn't always translate, right? The gi, depending on the competitor style and their style as a fighter, and all these variables that we're kind of finding out have to kind of line up. Not just wrestlers, but funk style wrestlers who embrace the catch as catch can. All y'all listening know, or will start to know, I'm obviously biased there, being that's, you know, one of my favorite grappling styles, and what, I guess I'm most ranked and experienced in, for whatever the hell that's worth. But yeah, that's where it generates my opinion, I guess is what I'm trying to say there. And, but you know, that's not just a biased opinion. You know, the proof is in the pudding. These guys do really well. Not only is the wrestling for the obvious reasons of top control, this or that, but these scrambly wrestlers, really, you can't count them out. You can't just, you know, put them on the back, you know, like a turtle, and they're helpless or anything, you know. Skelly can fight from there. He can fight from these positions. He can use leg locks, and not that he had to go to them. Thankfully, he kept it high percentage there. You know, he showed improvements in his stand-up. A lot of good things from Skelly. Liked his call out, looked in great shape. Moved to Florida, and despite the kind of Black Zillion split, he's doing, you know, he did well. He showed well. He showed the improvements of Hooft. I'm just interested if he's still working. I got to talk to Neil if he's still working with Neil, because I figured they'd be a good fit there. But Gilbert Nerino, obviously not a bad guy to learn to grapple from, who's working out of Combat Club there with Henry Hooft. Yeah, that's it. Sub prop hits. That was nice. And the next one was Curtis Blaydes versus Milstead. Like I said in the last one, I always got a soft spot for Milstead. You know, seeing him at his after party after his last win, doing those dance moves that he probably have a hard time doing now because of his knee. I will admit, I was one of the ones who was kind of vocal on Twitter, and not vocal as in pointing the finger at the corner, because again, I'm not a finger pointer, and just kind of my general approach and attitude in life. I try not to kind of do that. There's way too much red team versus blue team, you know, kind of thing. Not to use such a literal term in political climate, but you get what I'm saying here. Mac versus Apple, so on and so forth. I just think it's the lowest common denominator of intelligent thought and progress, much less humanity and human spirit. That's my opinion, and I just try to avoid that anytime. Try to not just play the middle or anything, but, you know, provide another point of view. I don't know where I'm going with this. I'm going to stop, because it's good. Just pretty much with a shovel, calling it a bulldozer, because I can't dig myself a hole fast enough. But I just wanted to raise the point, I guess, what I'm trying to say with my tweet was that we had the Cowboy thing that I also tweeted about, you know, and again, it wasn't an attack on Greg Jackson. I said in the tweet, I'm a Greg Jackson fan, but this is really uncomfortable. It's like, you know, I understand where the corner's coming from. I understand where the ref's coming from. I understand the concern of the audience, but it's just no one wants to take accountability. Because at the end of the day, we're choosing to watch this as fans. We love this. They're choosing to be there as fighters. They love this. They're getting paid for this. It's being sanctioned. There's tickets are being sold, and it's being accepted at a mass rate. But at the end of the day, there's these really fundamental questions about the structure of things, whether we want to look at this, you know, show to win and show to fight, or, you know, win bonus stuff, and what it kind of generates, how it makes these questions a lot, or makes these sorry, it makes these executions a lot harder to see clearly in the corners here, right? If we want to protect these guys, whether you're a ref or the corner themselves, because there is so much on the line. And, well, I guess maybe the refs aren't thinking about that, but I guess I'm talking more about the corners here. And, you know, I guess that's unpacking another argument. You'd have to look at why we even have that, right? Is that a carryover from the Japan or fight fix days where, you know, that was kind of a tactic to eliminate that and to assure that, you know, you get a good fight? Because now, you know, for a multitude of reasons, despite, you know, the Bellator main event talk, really, you know, there's not a lot of fight fix talk for good reason, because there's not a lot of real reasons and scenarios where it's kind of fit with the way the sport goes now, yet we're kind of still hanging on to these structures. And I'm not saying that that's where that structure comes from per se. Well, I'm sure someone will enlighten me on Twitter about it. But the bigger point is we do have to look at the bigger picture of the structure, because I think that that's what's making it hard. If we really do care about the safety of these fighters, if we do really want to get them paid, you know, we could potentially kill two or three birds with one stone if you really approach this huge problem, complicated problem, no doubt, but if you approached it right, you know, you could kind of sum up all these things, because they all kind of fall into the same line there. That aside, Blades looked good. He showed the reason why I picked him against Ngannou, and in our submissions and transitions, someone has a question on that, so I guess I won't go too deep, but I did pick Blades over Ngannou, because when I looked at Blades' NCAA footage and wrestling, you know, he was a very aggressive wrestler. I mean, it wasn't quite to that same, you know, affect as we saw what he did to Adam Milstead, but more or less the same. Those violent intentions were there, and that's what got me high on him, despite the lack of high level experience in MMA prior to the Ngannou fight, and what I'm talking about. Obviously, I took him here despite my soft spot for Mr. Milstead. And he came through, tossing him like the Hulk. Milstead gets sent back out, and he is blown in round two. Thankfully, it wasn't Milstead's previously bad knee, his left one, as James Lynch was tweeting out, who I believe interviewed him and was kind of talking about how that's what ended Milstead's career. So hopefully it's not too bad here. I mean, if you want more on that, I guess to wrap things before we hit the second half, on the status of Milstead's knee, how they think it's actually not as bad, and just hear from the corner themselves, my man from Flow Combat, Hunter Homestek, he interviewed the chief corner. I'm drawing blank on his name, but the ironic part, and you can go listen to the interview, it's actually a really good interview. The chief corner is a fighter himself, a professional fighter as well, and was in a similar situation on the other side of it, thankfully for him, I guess. But really ironic, really interesting, and I'm not trying to paint a picture either way with my tweet, nor am I trying to, you know, with the interview or anything like that. But it's definitely, you know, worth your time to go check out at flowcombat.com, and you can make a decision for yourself by listening to what the quarterman, his take on his vantage point and what he saw. So really interesting stuff, really great work from Hunter and the guys over at Flow to be on the ball. All right, that wraps the prelim card, and we're going to take a quick break here. Refill some drinks, some coffee. It's going to be a nice Sunday here. And come back and break down another solid six for you. Yeah, FS1, a full revolver of gunfights there, starting with Andrade and Hill when we get back right here on the Protect Your Neck podcast. Don't look back, don't look back.
Fast and skillfully forget.
back and on the we're back right here in the Protect Your Neck podcast for the UFC Houston main card recap. Before we get to the main card, just a quick shout outs that I missed earlier on that price pick. My man at Hedge That Bets hit a nice play on that, so I wanted to give him a shout there. And I almost wanted to talk about Cradles during the Skelly fight, but looking back at my notes, that was actually in the Tanaka fight versus Ramos. And just a kind of a side note there, I really like Cradles. Anyone who wrestles or is into catch wrestling, I'm sure you're a fan of it as well. But I'm really surprised we don't see it much more in high-level grappling or in MMA. You saw Tanaka use it well against Ramos. And it's just, I find it really good. Even, you know, when a guy wants to go for deep half, it kind of just shuts him down and gives you a nice grasp there. And you can start, you know, hooking and start weaving, leg weaving and looking to work from the cradle, you know, into a mount and doing some fun stuff, you know, combining that Damian Maya chain that BJJ Scout broke down so beautifully. Or, you know, just basic stuff when, you know, when a guy goes to try to turtle up or, you know, shrimp out in a way and kind of just containing and corralling them. Really like, you know, Cradles. They stifle very well. And, you know, at least the near side ones are there a lot in MMA because, you know, people are often usually kind of ducking into that area to avoid strikes or to work a deep half or a single leg to get up, which is a personal favorite of mine. So I just really like seeing Cradles applied and kind of shows that grappling IQ Tanaka that allowed him to be so successful in grappling in MMA despite not, I guess, the most experience or longest experience. But yeah, all right. Main card time. Angela Hill versus Jessica Andrade. Apparently we missed a awesome Misfits song, which is another reason why I love the FS1 broadcast, you know? Not just the amazing pacing that we love, but we miss intros. And I saw Bloody Elbow tweet, I believe Zane behind that handle, usually runs that, I believe, or Fight Nights, and said, man, bummed we're missing that. And I quote tweeted it just saying, I really second that as a Misfits fan. I don't know, it's probably Zane. Either way, regardless, shout out to Zane Simon. Another shout out there, but Zane is just awesome. And we share a lot of the similar tastes there, and his taste in Chinese kung fu cinema gives me respect for that man alone. So shout out to you, sir. Hill and Andrade. This one was obvious. I was a little biased here. I got to see Andrade work out here while she came out for 207. In case you don't remember, Rose withdrew, and they couldn't find anybody else. So I guess the UFC kind of bailed on that fight and scrapped it, but Andrade made some great connections through her management, Tiago Akamura. Great dude, by the way. Her whole team was really great, actually. It was just really kind of nice to see a team kind of just get behind a fighter without ego. Gilliard Piranha, Team Piranha, you know, her main gym there, main coach. They have a great relationship, and you could tell not only does he really care about her, but he cares about her enough to, you know, like a relationship. You love someone enough, you let them go kind of a thing. And, you know, because you want the best for him ultimately. And that really came across spending time with her and her team. And also my man Angelo Reyes, who you've heard on here. And, you know, he's really proud of the things kind of working with her. And even after the fight, because a lot of the plan, you know, that she kind of revealed, I kind of touched on a little bit in my interview, but she kind of said more after the fact, that essentially, you know, their plan is kind of piece by piece. I mean, there was a reason why they stood and didn't take Angela down, although it could have probably been an easier victory. There was a reason why they wanted this fight, not so much for a skill tune-up, but for a strategic financial camp move, you know, because they're going to, you know, spare no expense. So you really got to admire that. It's very smart, outside the box, but yet at the same time, common sense thinking right there by their team. So, again, I don't want to say too much about tactics because, you know, I was privy to some of these concepts and some of the things they're working with Andrade. And obviously, they're working with a lot of these things with the champion in mind. So, as is the kind of the second part of their plan, It looks like it's going to go through because, you know, the second part of their plan doesn't happen until Dana White says what he said, right? That Andrade was going to be the next for the title. So hopefully that unfolds well and there'll be more for that. I'm sure I'll be able to still write up something without giving away too much, so I at least present something like I did this time. But apologies that I didn't do my normal in-depth on that. Just trying to show respect that they were really respectful enough to kind of, you know, from seeing Angelo do his thing and work with fighters, you know, from Frank Mir to, you know, the work he's done with, you know, boxers at Wild Card and stuff, and kind of seeing a guy like that's experience his process, and then also, you know, Jessica Andrade and her team and seeing all that. So I come from that world, man. So, I mean, I'm a martial artist first, respect first, and I really just try to respect always everybody. Doesn't matter who you are, but I really kind of understand the unwritten rules of that world. So I hope you all are understanding of my limited comments on that. All right, shout out to Angelo Reyes, by the way. I know he's a listener now. All right, the next fight, Fortuna Hamilton, another miss, a miss of many. I know this one hurt a lot of people. I don't think this was on my official fights to avoid, but it would have been right there because that's why it kept me away from Hamilton. I mean, there was that common sense angle of the last minute debutante, low-level experience, 50-pound weight difference, wrong weight class. I mean, there was 10 reasons to pick against Fortuna, but at the end of the day, I have a hard time trusting Anthony Hamilton. To say the least. I mean, when you watch the guy's fights, I mean, poor guy's already in a division that one punch changes everything. But yeah, he got knocked out by a guy that was, what was it, 48 pounds lighter than him. Wow. And he never scored a knockout before, but he buzzed him early. I mean, step back right hands was kind of a theme of the night. We saw that a lot work. And you know, step, you know, just kind of planning and throwing that right. And I believe that's what Fortuna caught Hamilton with the first time. Not the time that eventually dropped him out. That was a nice 1-2 with that kind of weird turn on the angle. Not weird turn on the angle. I mean, you know, a lot of guys are trained to throw those crosses like that, especially when they're, you know, rolling out after they throw the cross. You know, when guys kind of roll out after they throw the cross, anticipating a check hook, a lot of times that fist will kind of turn a little more heavier. I mean, I've had different boxing coaches teach me to throw crosses that way as well. Gil Martinez is a boxing coach that comes to mind who I've worked with and actually had me throw crosses like that. Obviously, Fortuna's was at a very downward 45 there. But as far as the turning and stuff like that, it was really nice to see. It was really nice. You know, he committed to the technique. That's why, even though he kind of hit short of it, you know, Hamilton wasn't exactly at the end of it per se. It still obviously did the job. Whatever you have to say about Hamilton's chin, that would have starched and stunned a lot of the heavyweight division, with that clean blow, regardless of Fortuna's weight. So that was pretty cool. Oh yeah, that was a headbutt early that caught him. But yeah, Fortuna came back. After this fight, what was more funnier than this happening was the fact that I wasn't crazy, that, you know, my sick, twisted mind didn't just pick up on this, that a bunch of other people did too. What was up with the random zoom in on the freaking Latina that wasn't even, like, front row sitting in the audience? Like, it felt like the cameraman was, like, tripping over his own feet. He could not shuffle fast enough, you know, with this girl who just kind of had some bustage going on. What's it called? Cleavage? Heavy bus line. You get what I'm trying to say here, right? Without being too vulgar, grotesque, or obvious. But yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I would imagine it would have caught many of guys' eyes just out of general, you know, habit and nature. But a cameraman on a broadcast to kind of run over and kind of, look, zoom, 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 zoom. It was just really awkward. And like, that tweet got a lot of acknowledgement in both likes and replies. So I guess I'm not the only sick bastard out there, or I'm just not the only one that noticed that there's a cameraman that's kind of sick out there. So, yeah, whatever. That was random. Next fight was Volkan Ozdemir versus OSP. This was another one where there's plenty of reasons why you could have picked OSP here, but I had a hard time doing it, and for good reason. I'm glad I left him out, because up until this point of the card, my three teamers and five teamers were alive. I know, despite this spotty card. Yeah, and but you know, Volcan had a great, you know, great start. Found his range sooner. OSP was kind of banking on that left too much, left hand that is, and then not enough of his left kick, in my opinion. Not enough of his wrestling, which I've been kind of saying for a long while. I figured that was going to be a big key to his last fight, and it costed him because it wasn't. So surely he would have learned this time. And I know what everybody says about his camp, and I agree. I think a ceiling's been reached, but even if a skill ceiling's been reached, I mean, I was still thinking that an obvious game plan, common sense thing wouldn't be beyond the camp, like wrestle. And he did not. He had a few attempts, but just did not, you know, did not turn it on till the very end. And it was really awesome when he did. He really tried at the end there. And I thought it was enough to where I scored it for OSP. But similar to that Ramos-Tanaka fight, I would not have been mad if it went the other way. And, well, it did go the other way. I think OSP's like right side's going to be hurting, though, because, or left side, I think, whichever, because Volkan was hitting those inside leg kicks and left hooks all day. He must have looked at that Manoa footage, because, yeah, Volkan was variating those left hooks. So, good for him. Next one, Vicfers Trujillo. This was one I left out of the parlays, but I did play prop-wise. The official prop was, this was our second prop of the night, and that hit. So there's we were really looking good at this part of the night, despite, you know, still some of the spotty picks earlier. Money-wise, profit-wise, we did good overall, spoiler alert. But this was good because our, you know, I've been looking more at these does not go the distance, and it's real obvious to kind of pick heavyweight fights there if you're going to play that kind of a line or that kind of an angle. You shouldn't play, you know, any prop for fun, but which can be kind of easy to do for people that play props a lot. So you got to really show discipline on that. But I do believe that this is an appropriate angle when it's appropriate. I know that's just so much contradictory in there. And we're talking about MMA betting. So really, what the fuck am I talking about, right? But what I mean is, it's really easy to go for a heavyweight fight or a fight like this. Even though these guys are lightweights, you got to look at, you know, the volatility and how these styles clash. Not just the obvious evidence of first round finishes, finish rates, etc. That's obviously important. But I mean, kind of where they stack up, what the narrative it is going into the match. You know, sizes of cages, even though that's less of an issue these days, sadly. Those were the fun days, right? Anyways. But, yeah, you know, you got to take all these factors in. And this was one where I kind of forecasted and explained more in depth and thoroughly in my breakdown there on MixedMartialAnalyst.com why that was going to happen, or at least I felt that was going to happen. So yeah, good on that for hitting. But more importantly, I only kind of like I was talking to with my man John Lee at John's Crazy Life. Shout out to him there. Just did a fun sit down interview with him. We met up for some frosty gimmicks at this place called the Blind Pig here in town, and it was fun. We talked about how, you know, kind of break down fights. That's kind of his specialty. He likes to kind of pick apart guys' brains about that. And Pasquale's really cool videos, so make sure you follow him and check those out. But I was telling him, you know, third round props and props in general, you know, people that are against props, third round flyers are fun, but you know, even playing them for fun can be looked down upon, and I don't blame you. But as you know, you'll always see me put one third round flyer out there per card. Not necessarily by rule. I don't always do it. I think maybe the two before this I didn't. But when I do, there's usually good reason for it. And they use, you know, Weidman Romero. I had Romero round three. Or even when they don't hit, I still stand by it. Like I had, picking on poor Warley Alves, but Barbarina and Usman, I played round three props. And if you remember, Warley nearly went out by strikes to Barbarina, a flurry of volume strikes, and by a head and arm choke to Usman in the third round. So, I mean, you have to kind of do it against guys that are kind of front runners or faders, as mean as that word sounds. It's the truth when you're looking at kind of that angle for the third round flyer. And essentially the breakdown for this match was, you know, Vic's propensity to play on the outside of the cage is going to cost him like it did against Dariush, because that's Trujillo's preferred kill zone where he lands those big bombs, kind of where I saw Trujillo's follow-up left hand landing on Vic. But if Vic survived that storm, I felt Vic was very underrated in the ground, which I totally second him on kind of, you know, scolding people for underrating him there, because he does show some good things, even though there's not a huge sample size. I've liked what I've seen from him there. He uses his frame really well. And yeah, if he survived that aforementioned flurry and storm, he was gonna do better as his fight went on with his volume and pressure, and, you know, I feel eventually open up a submission. He almost had that Darce at first. I'm going off of one watch here, so forgive me, but it looked like I wasn't sure if he kind of sprawled out on it enough. He kind of had the angle, and his own criticism was he wasn't sure. He has to go back and drill it, Vic said, but Vic said sometimes with his long arms, a problem that I don't have, so I wouldn't know, he gets a little too deep, which makes sense, because I've seen that happen with other kinds of chokes and stuff before. It really all just comes down to adjustments and where you're kind of focusing on your leverage point. But it looked like he had it right as far as, you know, the arm across and, you know, under his chest and in the correct place. I wasn't sure if the squeeze or not was on there. I mean, again, I wasn't inside there, so I wouldn't know. You know, sometimes you can be in the grappling room and watching guys, you know, you're running a grappling class and watching guys work, and even when you know what you're looking at, sometimes it's just hard to tell unless you're in there, right? I mean, especially when you're at that level, it's a game of inches. But Vic finds it the next time, puts him out, cashes that third round prop, which was really, really nice. So thank you, Mr. Vic. That was cool. All right, next fight, Herrig versus Grasso. This one hurt me. This is where could have been about 5 or 6 units richer if the Grasso hit. We had the by decision prop. This was the one prop. We went 2-for-1 in props, 3-0 in parlay pieces. So the 3-piece hit. But yeah, the 5-piece doesn't, neither does this prop with Grasso. I will say, though, a lot of people were really more surprised than I was on this, because I was one of the few people saying, even though I'm picking against her, my hair is really underrated here, you know. But I don't really know how much I can triumph that flag, because even though as much as I want to give Herrig credit, I don't want to take away credit from her either, but you have to be honest, this was not the same Alexa Grasso, right? So it's really difficult to fairly praise or condemn either way. It really makes it difficult when you don't feel like you had an honest performance. Not like Grasso cheated us or that she was being dishonest. That's not the way I mean honest performance, but I mean honest performance as in normal, fair performance, however else you want to word it. But yeah. She was throwing, you know, in ones, and which is usually, not kind of getting off, not getting in her flow. And that's usually kind of Herrick's thing. Herrick usually can't get in her flow. She's usually only throwing ones and, you know, single body kicks, single teeps, not really following up too well. But Herrick did well in the clinch, like I thought. She gets the win. Good for her. Next is Jung Bermudez. As much as I wanted to take Jung, and I felt pretty confident in the path that he was going to win. I felt the angle to play this fight, even though I was picking Bermudez, was to play Jung, but to play him by submission, because I thought Bermudez's propensity to turtle, re-wrestling for shots, and possibly fail on shots, which he did. Excuse me. Would open up that front headlock chain where the zombie likes to go to the back, or work in his DRC Bravo variations, so... did not happen. He ended up knocking out Bermudez, which wasn't by any means out of, you know, possibility if you've seen the zombies fights in kickboxing or MMA prior, right? He always is a threat there, but yeah, you know, round one, and it's hard. I mean, he was getting caught up right early, didn't necessarily show that he fixed much, but he didn't show to miss a beat either, though. You know what I'm saying? So it's hard to place. You know, and then he lands a real nice, you know, slip off to the side uppercut. And usually the left hook follows up, but it didn't need to in this case. And that's something, as I said, he kind of, you know, he may have done it a bit in kickboxing, but he really didn't do it in MMA until about the WEC time, about Roop. You don't see it too much because it's just such a wild fight, that first one with Garcia, but that George Root fight, and then into his first fight in the UFC, you really start to see Jung really kind of hit that slip to the right, uppercut hook, and it paid dividends for him here. I initially thought maybe it was an early step in, but it was a good one. You know, those fast recoveries or not, it was more of a thing that Jung's punch has probably woke him up there. So that, you know, that's not much to say about that. It was just kind of a round one thing. Yeah, let's go to the submissions in transition before we wrap it up here. We only had two, but again, you say them, I'll read them, folks. So even if it's a hot take or whatever, questions or top fives when we do those episodes. The next one, we'll be doing a top five to the next off week, which I'm not sure is when. And I'll be back here in a couple days because I'm currently opening the book and, well, almost neck deep now by the time you're hearing this in UFC 208. So I'll have that breakdown up for you. So go ahead and use the hashtag #ProtectYourNeckPodcast to submit any questions you have, any particular prop lines, matchups, technical aspects, or random shit. It could be funny stuff, unrelated. I'll probably answer it, you know. Just, you know, try not to give me any dating advice because that is the worst. Although it would be comical, so whatever you don't mind embarrassing yourself with, you send it my way. And it will be in the submissions in transition segment, which is this one. The first one comes from Brendan McGlynn, at Brendan McGlynn there. Good old Brendan. Blades beats Ngannou after what he saw tonight, essentially, is what Brendan was saying. Yeah, man, in a rematch, I still got to give, you know, I could see Ngannou being favored and justifiably so with the run that he's been on, and he did beat Blades the first time, obviously, so, I mean, let's not get too crazy, but I did pick Blades the first time against Ngannou, right? And well, I can't say I would right off the bat, Brendan, but it's right up there. For contrarian, outside-the-box Dan Tom, my early lean is, you know, my early lean is a slight Ngannou, maybe like, you know, a -115, a -120 opener, and maybe Curtis Blades, you know, that +100, and you see the line kind of just battle back and forth from an even money up until fight week. I think it'd be, you know, maybe one of those. Maybe, you know, maybe that's just me. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm such an anti-hype guy that I don't realize how big the hype on Ngannou is, even though I'm high on Ngannou myself. And the line and the gap would be much bigger, and so would the line and the gap in the actual fight would be much bigger than their first fight, possibly. That's possible, too. But I don't blame you for thinking that, Brendan. You're not crazy at all, and people should keep that in mind. You know, people kind of scoffed the fact that I was picking Blades against Ngannou the first time, and again, I stand by it. It was a wrong pick, but I still stand by it. And performances like tonight, say what you will about the matchup against Milstead, but performances like tonight, Blades didn't make me look too crazy. All right, next one is from at Orion's Reflection. Says, the moment was too big for Grasso, but Herrig should not be praised for such a performance. So essentially, what he's saying is, yeah, okay, the moment, that's very arguable. Obviously, we're not in Grasso's shoes, you know, but with that kind of performance, you don't want to make excuses for her, or even though you don't seem to care to, you know, sounds like you'd rather, you know, pour it on Herrig, my man, which is your opinion, brother. You're welcome to it. Not gonna haze you. Appreciate you contributing, but we'll talk real about anything that's brought. And yeah, I mean, the moment too big, fair argument. You know, this is one of those things where Grasso could say she was injured or was sick, and I would believe her. And that's, I hate to sound so dismissive and disrespectful to Herrig by saying that, but just judging what we've seen from Grasso and what we saw that night, yeah, that's fair to say. Now, as far as the Herrig shouldn't be praised, I don't know about that. I was one of the few that was saying she was kind of underrated coming in, and just kind of one of those people that seemed to lack putting it together. I never really put too much weight into the mental stuff. I put it all together now because you never know. You hear that so much. I mean, I put weight into mental. Don't get me wrong. Obviously, the game's mental. She's totally right about that. But, you know, as far as the whole fighters projecting their narrative in this game, you know, if we believe everything they say, well, we'd be in for a bigger roller coaster than we already are in following this game of MMA. So you can't always do that. And I didn't do that. But I did think that she was kind of, yeah, a mental or physical hair trigger away from putting things to get, together and being a lot better than people think she is. And the tough part is I can't fully wave that flag, even though she got a big upset victory here, right? Because to your point, Grasso didn't look good. And that's kind of the unfortunate poetry of that matchup, if there is any. So I can't agree or disagree with you too hard on either one of those at Orion's Reflection. But thanks for contributing, my man. And thanks for everybody else just kind of talking. This was a real lively one, a lot of good conversations, and a lot of good go back and forth on Twitter tonight, or last night, I should say. Sorry, I'm getting you confused. But yeah, it was a real good time. So not much more shout outs or anything like that. This next breakdown should be on flowcombat.com since it's a pay-per-view event. Again, as for now, we're just kind of doing the big matchups and the big fight cards on Flow. The rest is going to be found on mixedmartialanalyst.com, where all my content from articles to this podcast is archived. A lot of requests for SoundCloud, so I think that's going to be the next one we add. But until then, we're on iTunes, so either find us there. Rates and reviews wouldn't be too bad, even if there's constructive criticism. You know, just any kind of participation there would be awesome. You know, or get at me on Twitter at the MM Analyst, or you know, follow this podcast and tweet your feedback there, your questions and stuff there at the PYN Podcast using hashtag Protect Your Neck Podcast. Again, I'm receptive. Not only will I answer, but I'll answer it in show if you use that hashtag in particular. So, get at me on Twitter. Very approachable. Love talking to y'all. It's always a good time. And until next time, protect your neck.